serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing now with 98-year-old Stu Headley, who is back at Pearl Harbor this weekend for the 78th anniversary of that world-changing day. When we left off, he had described witnessing the explosion that split the USS Arizona apart, but soon his battleship, the USS West Virginia, would be hit as well.
The next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber came through our turret, and what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane. The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode. And here's a picture of it taken on December the 9th. That's the inside of the turret.
And I'll put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. And I think some people who've been paying close attention are doing the math or following your drift on this. But go ahead and connect the dots for me from don't sit on two legs of a chair to the reason you're still here.
When the Arizona blew up, we didn't know it at the time. 1,177 men died instantly aboard that ship. You ever been out to Pearl?
Sure.
You've been aboard the memorial?
Yes.
You've seen the onyx wall, the plaque, with 1,177 names. But since then, there's been about, I would say, pretty close to 50 to 100 bodies put inside the ship.
Right.
So right after that explosion, I had my feet back up under. Right by my feet is a hatch, just big enough for a person to crawl through from one side to the other. It's locked down with four steel dogs. It blew that hatch right off those four steel dogs, that explosion. My footrest was just torn right off. If my feet had been out where they would be, I would have no legs, and I probably wouldn't be alive.
You wouldn't have made it off the ship.
No. Nobody would have known we were there because there was only the two of us in that right gun. And went right past my legs, underneath the elevating screw, past Crozen's legs, and landed against the barbette, picking both of us up simultaneously and throwing us 8 feet back into the elevating screw. Now, I had the JA phones on, and when I picked myself up off the deck, Crozen says, "Stu, let's get out of here." So I said, "A good idea," only he didn't say it quite that nice. And in order to get out, you got to go up a ladder to the primer deck. And when I got to the primer deck, I'd reached the end of the cord. And I grabbed a hold of the belt, snapped it in half, and threw the whole thing down in the pit. I spent 20 years trying to stretch one of those belts. Couldn't do it. And it wasn't until after I retired that I understood how it was possible. And I show the kids the Inquirer magazine that I had. And it says a mother lifted a one-ton car up off her son. And I said, that's an impossibility. But I read the article, then I understood. The adrenaline flows right through your body when you're in a state of excitement. So anyhow, we got on a topside. Our ship was on about a 15-degree list. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Tennessee is on one inboard of us. Now, a shell that hit the number two turret on the Tennessee killed my captain. Captain Benyon came out of his battle station walked around the flying bridge over to the starboard side when a shell hit the engine number 2 turret, and a piece of that shrapnel flew up and went through the lookout tower and tore my vice president's leg wide open. He got the Purple Heart. I never earned a Purple Heart for the whole war and the Korean War. And I told Crozen when we got out of topside, I says, if I don't get killed today, I'll live to see the end of this war. How can you say that, Stu? I said, if you've got the faith to believe it, you can do it. He says, I don't have that kind of faith. June 12th, 1942, he was on board the Honolulu. They took a torpedo through the bow of the ship. He was asleep in his bunk, and the steel crushed him to death.
And we're still in the early stages of this attack on the morning of Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You're up topside, but the reason you're saying, if I survive today, is that's not a certainty. There's still a lot going on. What happened next?
Well, while Crozen and I were watching the Oklahoma capsize, 12 minutes, Ensign Sears, a junior officer of our division, was screaming for us to get over on the Tennessee. And what he wanted us to do was to straddle the line and jimmy across. Well, while we were watching the Oklahoma go over, a plane zoomed in between the two ships and machine-gunned all five of our buddies, and they just toppled in between the ship.
So they're on the line between the two ships.
Yeah.
And they get picked off like sitting ducks by these Japanese machine-gun bullets.
Yep.
And I could see, as you described that, that the emotions are still stirred when you recall that.
Oh, yes. And I told Crozen, we're not going over any lines. How are we going to get over, Stu? I says, I don't know yet, but we'll find a way. As I was watching the Oklahoma capsize, we had 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft guns that stuck out over the side of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, Crozen, did you ever run down a railroad track? He said, what are you talking about? I says, did you ever walk on a well, when I was a kid, I said, you're going to do it today. What do you mean? I said, you see that gun barrel? We're going to go over in the Marine casemate starboard side, climb up on that gun barrel, run across it, and jump down in the Tennessee. The gun barrel is about that big around.
Yeah, a
for
couple
that
feet
five,
wide.
Five-inch. Yeah. And so he says, you go first. I says, okay. So I usually ask the kids, where do you think I was going when I hit the deck of the Tennessee? They don't have. I says, I was going right back up into turret 3. That's my battle station. You talk about Pavlov's law. And I was on the third rung when a Marine lifted me off with his foot. Crozen was still coming down the deck. And he said, haven't you had enough of those turrets? What do you want us to do? Get over in the beach. I says, how? Swim, you idiot. And the fire, as you saw in that picture just a minute ago, this is the oil that's blazing on the water from the ships. Crozen and I went over on the starboard side of the Tennessee. Here's all these nice, neatly piled clothes and shiny shoes. So I said, Crozen, we're going to strip down to our shorts, undershorts, and we're going to jump in. We're not going to dive. I says, we don't want to hit our head on anything. And I said, go just as deep as you can and swim underwater. Well, I qualified as an ABC swimmer in boot camp, not an underwater swimmer. But I'll guarantee I swam underwater that morning or I wouldn't be here.
How far did you have to go?
I would say about twice the distance we are to that wall. Not too far, but with that burning oil, and like I say, I wasn't an underwater swimmer, I came up twice, and I thrashed like mad to get that oil and fire away. Hottest breath I ever breathed in my life. It's a wonder it didn't scorch my lungs. Twice we broke surface. The next time we were at the beach, and they took us right over to the dispensary and walked right across the deck, and it's a great big red cross. It's an open patio style with a deck all the way around with a railing. And we went up there. They examined us for any burns or any lacerations, any wounds of any kind. And they had tables and chairs and cots, a bed that they moved out, anything that they could put a body on. I was asked to speak out at UCSD, and this gal said, Stuart, when you get to the point where you were at the dispensary, I want you to tell, you're going to be speaking to 85 doctors, surgeons, their admirals and generals, and I want you to tell them what your supplies were that morning. I says, Kathy, you mean that? I said, they've got the finest of equipment and everything. Yes. I said, all right. So when I got to this point, they gave us a tube of unguentine ointment put on the burns. They gave us a jar of sulfa drug. That's to pour into the wounds and lacerations. Then they gave us morphine, cans of morphine, to minister to those that were dying or in dire pain. With those three items, we saved lives. Well, we were taking care of these fellows, and it's now about 9:25, and the second wave is coming in. And while we were taking care of these fellows, I looked up and I saw two planes approaching Fort Island. And I yelled, duck! And we went under the benches, the tables, whatever we could. And glass just shattered all over the place. And one of the planes, when it lifted up, dropped a bomb right in the center of that patio. Now, 59 years later, on a Tiger cruise, the year 2000, we went over to Hawaii. And I told the fellas, I want to go to that dispensary that I was in. So I walked right across the decking, walked up the stairs, and they're all dental offices across there now. I walked in, and these are corpsmen that are working with dentistry. And I said, 59 years ago, I was in this building. It was kids. What are you talking about? They didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the history of it. And I said, yes, 59 years ago, I was in this very building. Well, one of the dentists, who was a lieutenant commander, heard me. And he came over and he said, did I hear you right? You were in this building 59 years ago? That would have been December 7, 1941. I said, yes, sir. Come here, I'll show you something. I had walked right across that decking. And I took a picture. These are the three fellows that were with me. And we stopped the car, and we took photographs of the bullet holes down the landing field.
That are still there.
Yep.
Yep.
And this is a picture where I walked across the decking, but when he took me back down, I took a picture of what he showed me. That's where the bomb hit.
They have one tile in the floor there now that says has a bomb, and it says December 7th, 1941.
Yep.
But on that date, I mean, this is a tile that's there now memorializing that.
Great big red cross was painted across that deck so that from the air you would know that it was a dispensary or a hospital.
But that's exactly where they hit.
That's where they hit.
It was X marks the spot.
You better believe it.
And what was the impact? What was the result of that bomb?
Well, dust flew all over everywhere, and I would say it was about 5 to 7, 8 minutes later that the dust cleared away. We looked over the banister. We didn't see a speck of red anywhere. Just literally tore that whole thing and turned it upside down.
The cross was gone.
Gone.
What about the patients that you guys had been treating?
They were still on the beds, but glass was all over them and everything.
You know, you've described all this, and I know you've told your story hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And I can't imagine how many lives have been impacted by your willingness to tell this story. But I'm struck by how much detail you remember. And the one thing I'm trying to figure out is how? How did you do all this? How did you manage to keep on going? And how terrified were you with this situation that nothing could have prepared you for?
Yes, there was a preparation. Because, see, we were out there a whole year.
Yeah.
Before the attack. And we had battle drills, we had gun drills, we had man overboard drills, we had all kinds of drills. that we were continuously practicing. So when the real thing happened, we're prepared and we do just what we're trained to do.
But
and
Stu,
you don't stop. And
but, Stu, you saw bodies flying through the air. Then your body was blown back 8 feet. And you're holding your breath underwater because there's fire on the top. And you get to the beach. And when you get there, there's all these guys who are injured and maimed and dying. And you're treating them only to get bombed again where you're treating them. I mean, how can anything prepare you for that? And what
the
was
Lord.
It that, yeah, that was it.
The Lord prepared me for everything. He assured me, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you whatever you go through. That was where my faith was and my trust. That was all during the war. I get up in the morning and I thank him for the night's rest. And I ask him to give me the wisdom, guide and direct me to the people that he wants me to talk to, and give me the message that he wants me to share.
And he is still doing that at age 98. The central message he's sharing this weekend in Honolulu, remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert. What a privilege today to share the memories of four amazing men with you. 78 years ago this weekend, they were four young men from four different states, Nebraska, Michigan, California, and New York, who had no idea how a Sunday morning in paradise would turn into a day that changed the world. There's a lot more to explore at hometownheroesradio.com if you have the time and the interest. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more of something our few remaining Pearl Harbor survivors have known for oh so long. Freedom is not free.